We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Philip has just lost the respect of the Youth League football team he coaches. He was asked what New England should do in the draft, and his answer was objectively terrible. The Athletic just wrote a great article about this, but Philip doesn't have the Athletic or the respect of a boisterous group of 11-year-olds who once looked up to him. Learn from Philip's error, get the Athletic, and get the info you need to speak draft fluently.
Welcome to the Solid Verbal.
The Solid Verbal.
Come after me! I'm a man! I'm 40!
I've heard so many players say, well, I want to be happy. You want to be happy for a day? Eat a steak.
It's that woo woo!
And now, Dan and Ty.
Welcome back to the Solid Verbal, boys and girls. My name is Ty Hildenbrand. Joining me, as always, over there in beautiful New York City, the one and only Dan Rubenstein. Sir, how are you?
I'm great, Ty. I am great. I just took a shower, and when I take showers before our shows, and I've mentioned this before, there's just something that reboots in me. I don't know. I love it.
I have yet to shower today. This sort of dichotomy will be on full display as we record today's playoff preview podcast, Dan.
Okay. I'm trying to tie it into something related to the playoff, like the absence of cleanliness on you is sort of the absence of consistent play from Oklahoma all season long. Like, you really drop the ball like Jalen Hurts has done a couple of times in key moments in terms of hygiene. No,
it needs work. We could roll through this a little bit more as we go through. So the way we've been doing this, all of our bowl previews this bowl season, we did two where we talked about the games leading up to the playoff, and we skipped over these two big games because we wanted to give them their due on their own show, which is what we're doing today. We've also got two other bowl previews that are yet to come. One of those is going to be released during the week. We are actually doubling up today and recording both of those shows on a Sunday morning so that we don't have to over the holiday week here coming up. And also, there's going to be another one that pops up next weekend to round out. I think there's like five or six final games that we need to discuss, but hopefully by now everyone listening has had a chance to get in on the bowl confidence pool. Dan, we had over 1300 entries in that.
Yes, we did. And my system of going with the team that has the better points per drive minus garbage time against FBS teams defense has been paying dividends somewhat.
Somewhat, yeah.
Somewhat after a few games only. And I think, we're not recapping games on this show. We're more looking forward to the playoff and discussing early National Signing Day. But we are recording this after the first batch of games. We'll be discussing it on the other show we're recording today. I can't keep all of this straight, Ty.
I know. But we're doing a weird time hop sequence here.
In any case, I am quite excited for these playoff matchups.
The playoff matchups, Dan. Why don't we start there? But before we do, don't forget to subscribe to the show. We'll be with you all off season long, all bowl season, while we're in the midst of that. Anywhere you get your shows, subscribe to the Solid Verbal. We are also out there on social media. Anywhere you get your social media, you can find the Solid Verbal. And also, don't forget to check out all of our old stuff at solidverbal.com, as well as join the conversation over on the subreddit at solidverbal.reddit.com, started by Verballers for Verballers. If you want to participate in the conversation, maybe you want to go and look to see just how I constructed my winning fantasy things roster for the 2019 season. That is out there as well. So much fun to be had if you're a Verballer. Not getting quite as much content as you did during the season, but alas, the offseason is long, and there are others among us.
Yes, correct.
Warning. Secure your belongings. This vessel is docking at the playoff port. Oklahoma versus LSU. Clemson versus Ohio State. Discussion of signing day and recruiting to follow.
I love that foghorn, but it's very dark.
It is.
This whole thing we got going with Wondery now, maybe rubbing off a little too much as we turn to the full-on murder genre here with the Solid Verbal.
I mean, there's just nothing very upbeat about a barge. It's very workmanlike. We are bringing our previews to port. We are transporting them to college football fans internationally. And so that's all I can go with.
So let's start at the very top here.
Yeah.
Are the correct four teams in the playoff?
Yes, he stretches out his yes answer ominously. Oklahoma has an incredibly strong case to be made, and I can't make a strong case against it, but I would probably feel a bit stronger if Tua were healthy and they still lost a shootout to Auburn like they did. So losing to LSU like they did, losing to Auburn like they did, which is plausible because Alabama's offense was still pretty robust in making plays and scoring points against Auburn. They just lost at the end. It would be weird to say that Alabama didn't deserve to be in it even with two losses because of how good that offense was. And even with not the greatest schedule, with what Oklahoma has done, going to overtime in the championship game, needing the comeback like they did against a very, very good Baylor team, which I know we'll get to when we do that preview show. It's the Sugar Bowl, I think, Georgia-Baylor.
Yep.
It would feel weird to me to say that Oklahoma is a better version of Alabama, but I also am on the record saying I don't want reruns. I don't want multiple teams from the same conference. So I'm a bit mixed on it. So I will simply go with the short answer now of I suppose
is the right answer.
Okay.
And I'm fine with this pairing. We will talk about the Alabama game, Alabama-Michigan matchup, I guess on our next podcast, which, as we said earlier, will drop in a few days. We'll talk about that game in a little more detail.
Yes.
But just the way things ended up shaking out, I think these are the four teams. I frankly don't know who else you would put in there if not for Oklahoma. So why don't we start then with the Chick-fil-A Peach Bowl? It does feature Oklahoma. Oklahoma won their conference. They finished 12-1. But they're in a bit of a bind here, being so they're a 13-point dog in the Chick-fil-A Peach Bowl against the LSU Tigers, who finished the year 13-0. They won the SEC. This, of course, is the first of two college football playoff semifinals, and they play it on December the 28th at 4 p.m. on ESPN, Daniel. So, right. You know, I try to look at these and often compare teams against one another. And what I kept coming back to, in some sense, is that LSU and Oklahoma have a lot that is very similar. These are two teams with really good offenses. Both, I think, have some questions on defense, to a lesser extent with LSU, but certainly that's the case, I think, on both sides. Both defenses did a really good job down the stretch, though, answering questions. And that, I think, is what we're really gonna home in on here when we talk about Oklahoma specifically in this game, because the question of whether or not their defense can continue with some of that momentum and find some way to offer resistance against this LSU offense, really what this one boils down to from a very high level.
Yes. So the easiest case to make is LSU most likely comfortably, I mean, what the spread is almost two touchdowns, right?
Yep.
About 12, 13 points. So the easiest case is to say Joe Burrow and the receivers led by Ja'Marr Chase. And I know Clyde Edwards-Helaire is beat up. I think it's a hamstring injury, I want to say, that he suffered in practice in a non-contact way. So hopefully he is at least somewhere near himself in this matchup. Yeah. I have yet to see a report otherwise. But that's the easy case because of what LSU did all season long, what they were able to do against Alabama, what they were able to do against the Auburn defense, even though that was lower scoring, what they're able to do against an incredible Georgia defense in the SEC championship game, especially with how LSU's defense looked against the pass with Derek Stingley all over the place, and presumably he'll be matched up against CeeDee Lamb. The case for LSU, while it's not simple, it's clear. The case for Oklahoma is trickier, but I think it can be made. I don't know what you have in the back of your mind as to how Oklahoma can not just stay in this game, but win this game.
Right.
Which I think they can. I don't know where your head lies with that, but to me, it's Lincoln Riley with the gift of time, the ability to run, depending on Kennedy Brooks' health, because we know Trey Sermon's not going to be playing. We know, you know, Oklahoma is not where they were earlier on in the season health-wise. Grant Calcaterra retires from football. But there is the case that Oklahoma, with time to plan, can run on LSU with a mobile quarterback like we saw a couple times during the season happen to the LSU defense. You know, Ole Miss, that wasn't really a game, but they ran on this LSU defense in a, sure, a creative mobile quarterback way, which Oklahoma should be able to do much better than that. They are better, yeah, built to do that and add a passing game than Ole Miss was able to do. So to me, it's that slowing down the game, chunk plays, picking on the right guy on the LSU defense, which is not easy. This is a good defense. That to me is the case for Oklahoma and being able to force a couple turnovers, be it in special teams or defensively, and they're going to have to do so without Ronnie Perkins, their clearly most disruptive force along the defensive line for Oklahoma, who's suspended, amen, in this one. So that to me is the case for Oklahoma to not just keep it close, but win this game, it all riding on Jalen Hurts on the ground, the rushing game, play action if LSU starts selling out against the run, and the magic of this being played in that same stadium where Jalen Hurts relieved Tua in the SEC championship game, if you believe in the emotion and pixie dust of intangibles here. So that's the, wow, case for Oklahoma. What is your Sooner case?
My case for Oklahoma revolves around two central questions. And the first, okay, is what I just mentioned. Can the Oklahoma defense offer any resistance? A lot of attention, at least if you watch the broadcast, is going to be on whether they can confuse, whether they can get to Joe Burrow.
Right.
Because Joe Burrow right now is all world everything. Just won the Heisman, will probably be the top pick in the draft, if not the top, one of the top five. So you're going to hear his name a lot. The issue there, though, for Oklahoma in trying to stop Joe Burrow is that it may come at the expense of Clyde Edwards-Helaire.
Helaire.
Now, again, his health is a bit of a bit of an open question here, but
sure,
I have not seen any reports to the contrary that he's not going to play, that he'll be limited. He ran for almost 1,300 yards, had 16 touchdowns on the ground. He also caught 50 balls out of the backfield. So this is someone who has been used to great effect.
Enormous difference maker against Alabama through the air.
So I guess the point is that it's not a straightforward argument,
right,
for that Oklahoma defense, how to stop, how to beat LSU. They can beat you a number of different ways. So that's the first thing that comes to mind. I realize that's the most obvious question. The second really does revolve around Jalen Hurts and him avoiding those backbreaking, those momentum-shifting turnovers that we've seen in big situations. I think you've rightly pointed out all year that he's not boom or bust. More accurately, he is boom and bust,
correct,
all within the same game.
Yeah.
And that's part of the excitement. That's part of the frustration with Jalen Hurts. If he can avoid those moments, he certainly needs to if they want to have any shot against LSU, because they need to maintain the football every time they have it. They need to try, mm-hmm, and get the most out of each possession. I don't know where your points per drive metric is on LSU and Oklahoma, but this is not a situation in which Oklahoma can surrender possession of the football whenever they have it. They just need to squeeze it for all it's worth, get every last drop out of it. And then on the LSU side, like you said, it is more straightforward, their path to victory. But, you, right, know, can they stop the big play? Can they stop Kennedy Brooks in the rushing attack if Oklahoma finds something that's working?
And Brooks plays and is near 100%. You remember he left that Baylor game.
Of course. Can they pressure Jalen Hurts?
Mm-hmm.
Can they pressure him? Can they get to him? So I think there are a number of questions really on both sides. I'm more confident that LSU has what it takes to get it done. But I agree with you. There's absolutely a pathway here for Oklahoma. What do we think for a final score of this game? We think it's high scoring. We think it's low scoring. Where do you come down in this one?
I think it is high scoring. I don't think it'll be necessarily reminiscent of the Rose Bowl between Georgia and Oklahoma. This is different. This is not Baker Mayfield. This is not that an offense that stacked to me, especially up front. But I think with that time, and also it should be mentioned, even though it's obvious, LSU and their offensive staff have just as much time.
Sure.
And have been crazy lethal this year behind a Heisman-winning quarterback. I think they're going to be points. I think I don't see it as being, you know, 20-something to 20-something. 20-something to something teen. I have it in the vicinity of like 37-28, somewhere like that. Like, I think it's going to go over 60 total. I don't think it's going to go wild 50s, 60s like that Rose Bowl in overtime. But I think a lot depends on Oklahoma's health, because if Kennedy Brooks is not himself and he's not playing, or he's just not anywhere near himself, the guy behind him is Ramondre Stevenson, who is also suspended alongside Ronnie Perkins. So the skill position thinness of Oklahoma potentially is worrisome. And the fact is, they don't have, other than CeeDee Lamb, there isn't that option 2, 3, 4 that's crazy scary. He sort of rises above. I know Charleston Rambo, as fun as his name is to say, had his moments, but CeeDee Lamb is that true scary, scary dude for
sure.
Oklahoma. It should also be mentioned, both of these defensive coordinators have time. So Dave Aranda does a fantastic job with time, and so should Alex Grinch. You talked about the confusion of Joe Burrow in this offense.
Yeah,
We've seen it a little bit. You know, at times against Mississippi State, certainly against Auburn, but this is not an Oklahoma defense built like those teams.
No.
So
it isn't. It isn't.
I'm going to take the points. I think there's too much potential for explosion from this Oklahoma defense, from Oklahoma offense, excuse me, to think that LSU runs away like they did against Georgia. I think it's back and forth enough that our old adage of taking the points in at least a pseudo shootout rings true for me. I think LSU wins this one by 9 points.
Okay. I have 52-41.
Whoa, I love it. I hope that happens.
As my final score. I had a good friend of mine at the Mysterious Day Job was filling out her bowl selections. And she said, as her tiebreaker, I need to figure out which one of these games is going to be the highest scoring. And this is the one that I put down. Now, given what we've seen so far, that might not be the case. But 52-41. I'm with you. 13's a lot. 13's a lot in a game that could be a shootout.
Underneath the weird LED lights of Mercedes-Benz Stadium. Fast track.
I think it's going to be high scoring. I'm going to get a little crazy with it. I do think Oklahoma covers. I am confident to the tune of 18 confidence points.
Ooh, okay.
In LSU here. I certainly could have been more aggressive with that number, but there is kind of a seedy underbelly to this game that feels like maybe Oklahoma could cobble something together. So I didn't want to get too crazy with it, though I do still like LSU a great deal.
Is there a been there element to this that gives LSU a disadvantage? Oklahoma's been in this position. Their coaches know how to schedule, you know, from an administrative perspective. You hear about with the Super Bowl, that the first time you're there, you don't realize how long, you know, halftime is and how long the pregame is, and to not get too excited,
I'm not buying into that, because LSU's been playing in the SEC and they've been mulling teams all year. They're familiar,
man.
They're familiar with big game situations. So no, I don't buy that.
They're familiar with it, but this is a whole different thing.
All right. But we do agree here. We do agree on the winner.
LSU's first playoff appearance, but we do agree. Yes. So you think it's going to play out in a more extreme version than I do, but we're on similar pages. I really just hope we have running back health in this game.
I agree. I agree. And actually, as kind of a natural segue over into the second playoff game, I think actually the theme that we are going to find through both of these playoff semifinals is that while all four, or I'll say all three and a half defenses are elite level, the offenses on the other sides of the field are way better.
Yeah.
And I don't know if any of these defenses are truly good enough to contain any of the opposing offenses. So I think both are going to be high scoring.
Yeah, I do like that we've gotten to a place where we are not seeing a defensive-led team in the playoff. I've long viewed, obviously, so a lot of people disagree with how I view college football's postseason, but I want this to be the best possible TV show. And to me, to my eyes, to my brain, I'm glad that we don't have the possibility, to me, of like a Michigan State. As good as their defense was during the regular season that year, it was clear why they were in that position. I'm glad we don't have this year's version of Georgia in the playoff, because that would have been...
We're going to get an angry email about that one.
Oh, but that's okay.
We've already gotten the angry Georgia ones.
Oh, my God.
It's okay.
Is there any other kind? Also, it should be noted on a happier front, Ty. This is the Chick-fil-A Peach Bowl, correct?
Yes.
The gift suite includes a $390 vanilla Visa gift card,
okay,
a fossil watch, and a football. I don't know what else is in the gift suite. Perhaps we'll get some behind-the-scenes video, but there will be hopefully some, this is a couple days after Christmas, but some happy, not really shoppers, but happy perusers among the Oklahoma and LSU roster going through the gift suite. And if you're attending this game, and we've mentioned Atlanta food before, Heirloom Market to me is the class of Atlanta barbecue, but I have not sampled everything. Mentioned Bees Cracklin, burned down, they're rebuilding, but in another location. Monero for Mexican food in the Ponce City Market, which is right by the Beltline. So you can have a nice meal and then go for a walk afterwards if it's nice out in Atlanta. Also, we went to Rhea's Bluebird, I think, for a delicious breakfast.
Oh, yeah. That's right.
That was great. So
it was good.
Those are my recommendations, and those are the gifts here.
If you're in this game, okay. Moving on. The PlayStation Fiesta Bowl, playing host to semifinal number 2. Mm-hmm. It is also on December the 28th, this one at 8 p.m. Eastern on ESPN. We have the Clemson Tigers, defending national champions at 13-0.
Mm-hmm.
Out of the ACC, we have Ohio State, 13-0 out of the Big Ten. Currently, at time of recording, Clemson is a 2.5-point favorite. So, scale of 1 to 41, 41 being most confident, 1 being least confident. Where do you stand on this game?
I like a 6.
I've got a 1 on this.
Is Jeff Hafley, I think he is going to be with Ohio State.
I believe
as is
so, yes.
Jeff Scott. The Jeffs are hanging around. So Jeff Hafley, the co-defensive coordinator for Ohio State, and Jeff Scott, the offensive coordinator for what's the name of the team? Clemson. they both took new jobs at Boston College and USF respectively. So that should not affect in a dramatic way our analysis, hopefully.
I had a real hard time with this game. And
as anybody should.
I have to warn our kind patrons. I really bought in early to the notion that this is the best Ohio State team I've ever seen. And with that as kind of a backdrop, there is some level of confirmation bias in this pick. I sort of approached it as looking for ways to confirm my gut instinct, which is not the way you should go about picking games objectively, but I just had a really hard time here. I've personally seen Ohio State a lot more this season. I'm more familiar with what they've done. With Clemson, so many of their games have been blowouts against lousy teams, and it's hard to find that frame of reference as they now go into this matchup with Ohio State. I found myself going back a lot to last year, which has some validity, but not all that much, being so it's a different team and a new year and all that. So I had trouble with this one, real legitimate trouble, and bounced back and forth about 1,000 times. Yeah, I did.
So what weighed on you?
Well, I don't find a whole lot of daylight between Ohio State and Clemson or Clemson and Ohio State in most statistical metrics.
Right.
They're both so good. It feels like a situation where it comes down to like a missed kick or a fumble on special teams or a bounce. Something goes one way or the other.
So I think it's more of the proven versus the assumed Ohio State, we've seen against Penn State, Michigan, Wisconsin twice. That's the meat of their schedule.
Sure.
They've largely, you know, they fall behind to Wisconsin in the Big Ten championship game, but they've largely just separated themselves from those teams, be it immediately, be it over time, be it late. They haven't left out against true meat. We know that this is actual meat as opposed to like an Impossible Burger, a Beyond Burger, whatever, a veggie burger.
Sure.
We know that there is substance to the best of their schedule. With Clemson, we assume because Clemson is performing how a great team should perform against a lesser schedule, be it Virginia or, you know, Texas A&M is fine. They're good enough, I guess. It's hard for me to say good, but it's a respectable opponent. But we haven't seen Clemson pushed by anybody, I guess, beyond North Carolina, who is another team that's fine. But after that North Carolina game, they John Wick the rest of their schedule.
They went nuts. Yeah, and so that is my point exactly.
It's a hypothesis that Clemson is amazing with a lot of proof, but we haven't seen it fully bored out.
I think we're going to see another high scoring game here.
Interesting.
And as I said a few minutes ago, I do.
Could be the two best defenses in the country.
Both defenses are really good. Mm-hmm. I don't think either is good enough to keep it low scoring. And, you know, again, to the point of Justin Fields and J.K. Dobbins and Trevor Lawrence and all these big names that you're going to hear a lot about.
Dobbins.
Thank you, Gus. I think Isaiah Simmons, and not to say he's not a big name, he's going to be a very high draft pick.
Butkus Award winner, yeah.
He's not going to get the fanfare of some of those other skill position players. I am watching Isaiah Simmons the closest. He's a linebacker from Clemson. He's kind of a tweener. He's like a blueprint for what a modern linebacker should be. He's big enough to fight through the trenches and make those havoc plays, which we talk about, mm-hmm. but also quick enough to cover the pass like a safety, kind of like a safety in a linebacker's frame. I'm interested to see how Brent Venables deploys his talents. How do you use him to affect Justin Fields? Because Justin Fields has been effective not only as a passer with a 40-1 touchdown to interception ratio this year, which is amazing for a sophomore, but also as a runner. And they have used different versions of Justin Fields as needed to change the complexion of a game. We saw it in that Wisconsin Big Ten championship game. Second half was an entirely different story because of a few tweaks here and there. So how does Venables deploy Simmons in a way that can try to contain Justin Fields? I don't know. And that's why I'm asking. That's part of why I'm so confused as to which direction to go here. Larger point being, though, I still don't understand how either defense is going to contain the opposing offense. I just think it's going to be another shootout.
So I think Clemson's defense is better. And it's, I think, I'm not sure, but my hypothesis is that
Clemson's I would agree with that.
If by the narrowest margins, they're so good across the board. They've played so many players. They have the best pass defense in the country, according to SP Plus, and the second best rush defense. So you have to say, well, I guess they're vulnerable against the run. My concern about Ohio State is, one, they've played closer games late against good, but to me, not great teams. And that's fine. The Wisconsin game was impressive the way they came back and put an exclamation point on it. I think this defense is incredible and took an incredible step forward after a couple of sort of strange years, given the talent on Ohio State's defense. The thing I'm most concerned about in this game is I don't think Ohio State and their defense, especially their secondary, I don't think they've seen a receiving core. I think they've seen a couple of good receivers. I think they've seen a couple of okay, fine quarterbacks. They haven't seen Trevor Lawrence. They haven't gotten to that elite point through no fault of their own. I just think it's going to be new. We saw the way that as soon as Clemson got that crease against Notre Dame last season, I think this year's Ohio State team is definitely better than last year's Notre Dame, but all it takes is that crease. We saw the way that game changed was Julian Love got hurt.
Yep.
We saw the way that just Notre Dame didn't have the depth or experience to handle Clemson on offense. And again, I think Ohio State's defense is better than Notre Dame's was last year. But there's something about the number of ways that Clemson's offense can take over a game that Ohio State hasn't fully been tested doing against Shea Patterson or Sean Clifford or Jack Cohn, as much as you love King Cohn. I think Clemson's in a better place, and I have difficulty saying, well, because they did it last year. It's a different team this year, obviously. They get after the quarterback not as well because of last year's defensive line, but there is something about that upper echelon of receiver for Clemson and how well they're developed that it just seems so automatic that I worry a little bit about Ohio State's secondary. They've been beat up the last couple weeks of the season. I assume they're going to be a lot healthier. But that to me, if I'm picking nits, as they say, Ty, that to me might be where Clemson can separate themselves.
I think it's fair.
It's a Trevor Lawrence over Justin Fields, not dramatically, but that's my ruling.
And we have to at least mention Chase Young.
Oh my gosh, of course.
As part of this preview and how he might be able to change the game. Obviously, if you can get the Trevor Lawrence, take him a bit off rhythm. It's not something many have been able to successfully do because Clemson's offensive line is still pretty killer. But that is certainly something that Clemson knows going into this game, and I think Ohio State fans are anxious to see unfold. If he can get to Trevor Lawrence, try to change the pacing of this, that could help them here. I do worry similarly about the Ohio State defense. I do agree with you that Clemson's is better.
We don't fully have proof, but back to the original line of the show. We suppose they're better.
I am picking Ohio State here.
Ooh.
I am picking them on the assumption that they'll have some way, they'll figure something out to deal with the Clemson pass rush, which I think is going to be never ending and unrelenting in this game. I think they're going to bring the full fury of Brent Venables at Justin Fields in this one. But I am so far down the rabbit hole of Ohio State being the best I've ever seen that I think I have to pick them. So I think it's high scoring. I think it's very close. I think it's last one with the ball wins. I think it's something like 45-37.
Whoa. Ohio State.
Yeah.
I think you've shot beyond me. I have it at like 35-31 Clemson.
Okay.
I don't know. What did you say the spread was? It's only a couple points.
2.5 in favor of Clemson.
2.5. So I think they barely cover. Yeah. And again, maybe it's, I don't have any data behind it, but we've watched sort of first-time coaches come into the playoff and take a couple licks before figuring it out. And we've seen it, you know, Dabo against Alabama in the Peach Bowl where Kelly Bryant started, where there are licks to be taken when ascending to this level, and the amount of experience that Clemson has in the playoff and sort of peaking at the right time, I think by the narrowest of margins is the difference.
So there you go. We disagree on the second one, but like I said, I've got one confidence point on this game. I have no confidence whatsoever in that pick being accurate. I'm really looking forward to both of these, but this one in particular, because depending on which way the wind blows, it honestly changes my opinion.
Yeah, and we talked about running back health and hoping for it in the previous game. Travis Etienne against J.K. Dobbins is probably the best possible running back matchup we could have hoped for in a game of this magnitude, right?
Yeah, oh, for sure.
And both of them, as well as the rest of those rosters, gift suite includes PlayStation 4 gift package.
I was going to say it has to include a PlayStation 4, right?
Do you have a PS4? Or are you Xbox? What are you doing?
No, I'm PS4.
You are PS4.
Yeah.
You like it?
Of course I like it.
Okay. Fossil Watch and Ogio Shuttle Pack Backpack. History of the Bulls Celebrating the Good of the Game book. Ice Shaker Insulated Bottle to keep you hydrated, Ty.
Okay.
If you're going to the Valley of the Sun, may I suggest, I've said it before, Pane and Pizzeria Bianco, but I've also been told Pomo? P-O-M-O. I don't know if it rhymes with FOMO. Palmo? Pomo? Pizza? I looked it up. It looks delicious. Also, Tacos Chiwas. C-H-I-W-A-S. Also, a delight. But, you know, do some research. Don't sit in traffic for food. Figure out what's nearby and do that. There's good food all over Phoenix. I think it's an underrated food town. So, enjoy yourselves out there, yourselves, especially if you're coming from the Midwest. Hopefully it's warm and gives you some time in the pool or play some golf, something like that.
There you have it. Those are your two playoff semifinals. We'll obviously be breaking down the national championship after these games are over.
Mm-hmm.
But for now, This is where it stands. As we said earlier, we will be doing more bowl previews throughout the course of the next week or so. So make sure you stay tuned in for those. But as for now, we didn't have any opportunity to really talk about recruiting, did we?
We, the two of us, did not, no. And the good news is you will get both our semi-educated opinions, and also I spoke with our old pal of 24/7 Sports, Brandon Huffman, to get everything in order. But before we get to that, Ty.
Yes.
What were your thoughts about early signing day, surprises, Notre Dame's class, anything reinforcing, more of the same? What were your takeaways?
I was really happy with Notre Dame's class.
Good.
To be honest. Yeah, I was pretty happy about that. And I'm glad to hear that you talked to Brandon to get more detail on it. But I thought they did a good job. You know, Clemson, Alabama, Ohio State, Georgia, LSU. That's your top five. Any surprises there? Of course not.
The magnitude with which Clemson is now recruiting is surprising in that it's just crazy scary.
6 5-star recruits, according to 24/7. So not a bad haul for them. Texas A&M jumped up and did really well for themselves. I thought that was admirable. Jimbo Fisher trying to put some of those hard-earned Texas dollars to work.
Correct.
The big takeaway for me, and I know you talked to Brandon about this as well, but out of what, 65 Power 5 programs?
Something like that, yeah.
USC finished 64th.
And part of that is that it was a very small class. And the way these classes are graded is based, you get a certain amount of points or something per 3-star, 4-star, 5-star recruit. So I don't know what USC's average commitment grades out at, but I think there was one blue chip recruit in this class. So that still wasn't great. I asked Brandon about this, and he'll explain, you know, his theory, because my theory, I think, is similar to what a lot of people think. Like, you have, you know, the uncertainty of Clay Helton's future hanging over the program. Why can you expect them to recruit well with so much uncertainty about who's going to be the head coach? Brandon explained it. It actually made sense that it wasn't necessarily that being an overwhelming reason why. But yes, I think you're right. You have the usual suspects. I thought it was interesting, and Brandon touched on this too. Clemson and Alabama, the jewel of their classes, are arguably their 5-star, it was a pro style for Clemson and a dual threat for Alabama, quarterbacks. Both of those quarterbacks are from Southern California. And the fact that they are expanding their reach, you know, I think LSU has done pretty well in Southern California at times. Clemson did it last year with a guy or two. Alabama's, you know, obviously Najee Harris is from, I think, the Fresno area, Northern California, either way. Alabama's done well in California. But now Clemson, which is a relative newcomer to this blue blood platform of theirs, they're really stretching their muscles nationally, at least going west to California to add to the Southeast. Notre Dame, I mean, Brandon touched on it. Oregon closed really well with Noah Sewell, the younger brother of All-American left tackle Panay, at linebacker, and then Justin Flo on early signing day, announcing another 5-star linebacker for Oregon. Brandon touches on that. I thought Mike Norvell did a good job. He flipped Chuba Purdy, younger brother of Brock, from Louisville to Florida State, and nicknamed Chuba because he was born... Well, no, at his first birthday, he was 38 pounds, which the solid baby is somewhat big at like 23 pounds.
Okay.
At almost a year. So that gives you an idea of where things lie. But yeah, he touches on USC. He touches on some new coach stuff, some G5 schools that impressed. Penn State's class was fine. Michigan's class was fine. But the distance between them and Ohio State appears to be growing. The gulf is growing.
Man, 38 pounds is like Glenn Dorsey. That's huge for a kid.
That is, it is dense beyond words. It is something like how they describe space rocks. Like we haven't seen anything
that belongs
constructed
on the,
like this.
On the Absolute Unit subreddit right there.
Yes.
I did see that our boy Mike Loxley flipped Rakeem Jarrett.
Yes.
The 5-star wideout. Yeah, flipped him from LSU. A local kid in the DMV got him to commit to Maryland, which was a nice win for him on signing day.
It was after the fact, but Clark Phillips, who is a corner from, I think, Southern California, who was committed to Ohio State forever, Jeff Hafley leaves. He has second thoughts. He ends up flipping to Utah, which Utah's had to get it done developing three-star types. Clark Phillips is, I see here, the number four corner in the country. So they are increasing their talent level. So that should be scary to the rest of the Pac-12. So there was nothing dramatic. We saw, I think, a big win for South Carolina and Jordan Birch, the best defensive lineman in the class. I don't know if he's signed as of now, but interesting nonetheless, because the gulf is only increasing between the haves and have-nots, talent-wise.
The other school that really jumped out to me was Georgia Tech. And, you know, I know Tech didn't have like a top 10 class or anything like that, but this is obviously a rebuild in progress. And as part of the coaching turnover, one of the themes that we heard repeated over and over again in the preseason was how they were really going to sell Atlanta.
Sure.
It didn't feel like Atlanta as the home base for a college football entity was being sold hard enough. And what, they finished top 25, 24th year, according to recruiting rankings, did well with getting the quarterback, really did hoard that Southeast area, a lot of Georgia, a lot of Florida kids in that signing class. So maybe there's something to that.
Sure. Oh, there absolutely is. No, I mean, especially if you're from the Southeast, if your grades are pretty good, if you want to be in a bigger city, Atlanta's the option.
Yeah.
That's, I mean, I guess you could point to Miami, but in terms of college town, and it's just not that Atlanta is a college town, but in terms of appeal right now, I think, and the ability to play early, even though Miami did finish with a nice enough class, I like that. I like it from Jeff Collins,
five,
the Yellow Jackets.
5 four-star kids, not bad.
Should also be mentioned, because we are going to have to learn this, Clemson's 5-star quarterback from Southern California, who chose the Tigers over Oregon, DJ Uiagalelei. We'll have to get it right eventually, but right. There are a lot of letters.
So why don't we do this? Why don't we jump into our interview?
Yeah.
Your interview with Brandon Huffman. He can break this down in alarming detail, because that's what Brandon's good at. We'll rejoin on the flip side. We'll send you on your merry way and leave it there.
All right. Thanks, future Ty. I don't know how to word this, but this is the portion of the show in which we bring on our long, long, long time friend. See how I didn't say old friend, because I respect the youthful glow of Brandon Huffman of now 24/7 Sports. Brandon, we're a day after early signing day. How's life? How you doing?
Hey, I'm good. You know, I love the NCAA thinking of us and giving us a few days off before Christmas, before they make us do it all over again in February. But you know, some of these guys are taking advantage of this 3-day signing period and announcing the day after. Some are announcing the 2 days after. And then it goes dark. It goes quiet for a couple of weeks. So I'm just trying to get through the next couple of days and then having all this fun to get to do it all over again in 6 weeks.
Hooray. And I want to be clear. You have an official title. I just assume that they keep adding to it at 24/7. Are you senior platinum diamond executive national recruiting director of all operations, something like that?
Yeah, with maybe a little bronze in there as well, just to show my youthful glow.
I love that. Okay, let's start here. We are now through the early signing period of sorts. We have All-Star games coming up a couple weeks from when we're recording this, with a few more pretty major announcements. But to you, with the bulk of the early part of the signing day situation in college football done with, who made statements, be it that their talent level is, you know, staying extremely high, that their talent level is quickly rising to a high level, or even something more negative, that they're struggling? What were the big headline statements to you?
Well, I think the biggest statement obviously was Clemson, for I think the first time ever having the top recruiting class. And I think what's been so remarkable about their run under Dabo Swinney is that they've had years where the majority of their team that was a part of that national championship squad were about a top 15, top 20-ish class, and now they're trending upward. Yes, they did sign the number one player in the country 2 years ago when they landed Trevor Lawrence, and they got an immediate return on that with the national championship he won as a true freshman. But this year, they had one of the most complete classes, and this will give you a little bit of a insight into what kind of recruiting juice they have. They were able to get a 5-star kid who had been a top 15 kid with offers from all over the country.
Right.
They were able to slow play him, bring him in for an official visit the weekend before signing day, offer him on the visit and get him to commit. You know, that's when you know, it reminds me of the Pete Carroll USC days where they would get these local kids to do that, that were committed to these other Pac-12 schools. And the night before signing day would ignore them for 11 months. And then the last 11th hour offer them, they'd get them. That's what Clemson's been able to do. They have 6 5 stars. They missed out on a couple of guys they thought they may have a chance to get, Justin Flo, Jordan Birch being one of them, which would have given them, you know, almost a quarter of all the 5 stars already. But 6 5 stars, that double what the next two teams with 5 stars have, Alabama and LSU, both have 3 each. But I think you're now seeing what Clemson's able to do recruiting wise. And, you know, it doesn't seem like they're going away anytime soon. I think the one school that you look at that made a statement on the other side of it, and this is something that, you know, you and I being West Coast guys are not used to seeing, that is USC.
Right.
You know, when you see USC 12th, you're expecting that to be kind of their floor nationally. You would never think you'd see a day where USC was 12th in a 12-team conference. And yet here we are. They're the number 12 team in the Pac-12, only have, I think, 11 commits. They are behind schools, you know, established programs like Bowling Green, Troy, Toledo, Western Michigan.
Yeah.
And when their headline recruit is a three-star from Southern California, who they got largely because his older brother's on the team, that kind of gives you some insight into what kind of day USC had.
I want to go back to Clemson for a second, and then we'll go back to USC, and then we'll go all over the country. But Clemson is not in a conference that had, or at least the past couple of years, they haven't played in huge headline games. You hear a lot of recruits talking about going to the SEC and that big time atmosphere. And obviously, they've overcome the fact that there aren't huge games in the ACC, or at least recently, because you're playing in January on a huge stage. Why does that not matter for Clemson? And why does that matter sometimes for a conference like the Pac-12, say, that also is struggling to put together, you know, a headline slate? Is it just the January thing, or is there something else that really is pulling kids to Clemson?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a combination of the two. They're playing in the ultimate showcase mm-hmm. game, the ultimate big setting, whether or not it's in a college stadium or most of these games seem to be in NFL stadiums. It is the game that every team wants to play in at the end of the year. And then on top of that, they have a lot of those guys sitting in the green room on Thursday nights in whatever town the draft's in, getting drafted. And so when you're at the point where you're competing for national championships consistently, you're putting guys into the high rounds of the NFL draft consistently, it feels like you can't turn on a Sunday night football or Monday night football game without a receiver from Clemson, a cornerback from Ohio State being announced. And Clemson has now put themselves in the mix where they're, you know, a blue blood. Essentially, they're a blue blood as we look at it right now. You know, 5 straight years in the playoffs. What is this, the 7th major bowl that Dabo has been to in the last 8 or 9 years? And what they're doing recruiting-wise, what's probably the most remarkable part about it is that they are spreading their wings nationally. You know, you never really thought Clemson would be a program that would recruit on the West Coast, yet for the 2nd straight year, they go into the Golden State and they get one of the top players in the state, this time getting DJ Uiagalelei, the number one pro-style quarterback, a year after they got Joseph Ngata out of Sacramento at Folsom High School. So when they are able to recruit the West Coast and get a premier player in the West Coast like DJ, when they can go up into the Northeast and into Maryland, the DMV, and get Brian Bresee, who's the number one player in the country, continue to recruit in Florida, you know, go down into Texas and get guys, get other players in the key states and in the Southeast, and just really pick and choose. I mean, they're at the point now where it's almost like they're not even recruiting anymore. They're just evaluating because they're going to be able to get who they want.
Right.
If they make the right evaluation on that kid, it's very much what Nick Saban's been doing the last decade. But now Dabo is at that point where his coaches can pretty much walk anywhere in the country. One of the top players in the country in the 2021 class is a receiver just outside Seattle, and Clemson's in his top 2 or 3. So they are being very picky about who they recruit nationally, but they've got the ultimate logo on their shirt. When they walk on a college campus or a high school campus now, they have serious cachet.
USC came off of a season that ended pretty successfully. Obviously, the 2018 season didn't go super well and was disappointing. And there's been uncertainty around Clay Helton and his staff and his job status. Is that the only thing to blame? Is there an element of Clay Helton and his staff not knowing their future? So why are they going to go out and recruit for 20 hours a day? Why are they going to be texting kids? Why are they going to be coordinating their recruiting staff to put together, you know, graphics for recruits? Is there an element of the fact that we didn't know his status until essentially last week, that is just destroying USC from the inside.
I think that's what we are, what people are using as a crutch. I don't know that it's something like that. I think they're just getting flat out outworked. You know, you look at the coaches that were removed after last season, and he made some key changes on the defensive side of the ball and made some changes on the offensive side of the ball. T. Martin, who had been one of their best recruiters, was let go. But then they had a couple of recruiters on that staff that just did a horrible job of evaluating, a horrible job of recruiting, and essentially mailed it in. And when you lose, you know, there was an article this week about how the second-year bump with the early signing period is no longer there. It's not the third-year bump. When you bring assistant coaches in January, they're already behind for the following class. And so forget the class that's going to sign at that point. And you can almost forget the next class. You're almost having to build 2 years out to start building that relationship. And so even though he made those changes, you couple those with the uncertainty in his job, it certainly doesn't create a positive scenario at USC. But what's really happening is the team's down. I don't think it has so much to do with Helton and the job instability. It's the team has not been remarkable really since that Rose Bowl game against Penn State 3 years ago. You know, they were one of the more underwhelming 11-2 conference, or what was it, 10-3 conference champions 2 years ago when they won the Pac-12, but then lost in the Cotton Bowl to Ohio State. And it seemed like the storyline every week was, you know, Sam Darnold, and was he going to turn the ball over? They were, you know, even then they weren't wowing people. And just at that point, Oregon had had Willie Taggart, even though he had left, they'd replaced him with Mario Cristobal. Oregon started to take off with their recruiting in Southern California. Washington was starting to really take off with their recruiting in Southern California. Then Arizona State comes in the next year and brings Antonio Pierce on staff with his Southern California ties. And now they start making in fact, it was right around the same time. Yeah. He comes in and he starts making the inroads into Southern California. So now all the Southern California kids are seeing all this attractive programs outside of Southern California. Chip Kelly does whatever he's doing, and Clay Helton's doing what was supposed to be able to do, and it's not working. And all the rest of the Pac-12 is being able to infiltrate Southern California, but then the national programs are coming in. Ohio State has five guys from the West Coast and four from California. So it's not just so much the instability and the uncertainty around Clay Helton. It's the program just doesn't look like, you know, it's trending upward, and guys are more attracted to playing elsewhere. And if they're going to stay in the Pac-12, they'd rather go play at Oregon. They'd rather go play at Washington. They'd rather go play at Arizona State. And those three schools, incidentally, are trending upward recruiting wise.
What were the biggest surprises to you in terms of flips, in terms of new coaches, in terms of somebody finishing strong, and in terms of somebody not finishing strong? What sort of, even with how dialed in you are, made you sort of raise an eyebrow on Wednesday?
Yeah, I mean, I got to say that Justin Flo committed to Oregon. It wasn't a surprise so much. I mean, Oregon had definitely been trending that way. But, you know, Dan, you and I, we're both from Southern California. We've seen this movie so many times. Yep. Even when USC was at its most down, they still would be able to pull one or two guys that nobody thought they were going to get, and they would still find a way to pull them in. And you just thought, you know, even though Oregon was in this position a couple of years ago with Devin Williams, they had been in this, you know, in years past. You had essentially the DeAnthony Thomas moment of this modern era with Justin Flo spurning USC to go to Oregon. And the fact that SC was even in it to get an official visit was big, because they weren't even in his top five a few weeks ago. But then when they got the official visit and they got the last official visit, you just started to think, okay, here we go again. And he spurns him and he goes to Oregon. So I think the big surprise is, you know, just how easy Oregon has made it recruiting in Southern California. That's 2 years in a row now that they've taken the number one player on the West Coast, who happens to be in Southern California, out of schools that USC has recruited, out of regions that USC has recruited well, and taking the top player. And the interesting thing is, this is now the fourth time in the last 10 classes that Oregon has got the number one player in the West, who happened to be from California. Three times there were players that were from Southern California, and the other was the younger brother of an SC player. Oregon is continuing to make inroads in the state of California, Northern and Southern. So I think the surprise was just how easy it was for them to end up getting a Justin Flo. You know, Florida, there was a lot of targets that they were waiting on and that they thought they were going to be in play for, and didn't sign, I don't think, really anybody yesterday of significance. The one that's the surprise to me, I mean, we're used to seeing them in the top 5, top 10 basketball recruiting rankings. North Carolina, they're in the top 20. Number 19, Mac Brown is wowing and wooing people down there in Chapel Hill. And, you know, there's always one or two schools that you don't really expect to see in the top 20. And North Carolina is one of them. But the other one was South Carolina. You know, considering the year Will Muschamp had and considering just the up and down nature of his coaching regime at South Carolina, for them to be able to get a commitment yesterday from Jordan Birch, a top five player in the country. Now, they're still waiting for his letter of intent. But they got his commitment. LSU felt really good about getting him. You know, Clemson had been in the mix heavily for him. He had all the usual suspects. And a 4-8 South Carolina team was able to get, and more significantly, I mean, he is from Columbia, so they definitely had the home field advantage. But those are the kind of guys that had been going to Clemson, those elite in-state kids. And Will Muschamp was able to pull that surprise. Now he just needs to get that letter of intent to make that official. But, you know, I think it's more of a surprise to see who are some of the teams that closed well that we're not used to seeing. And more importantly, the team that closed as poorly as possible that we're always used to seeing being one of the best closers when it comes down to signing day.
If you travel for work, you know to pack two suits, business and swim. You know, with your Delta SkyMiles Business Amex card, buying that plane ticket for a business trip can get you closer to medallion status. You know that a meeting in Montana means visiting almost every national park.
Yellowstone? Check.
Because you're the chief excursion officer. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum Business American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/youknowbusiness.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
So one of the things the early signing period does is it makes it crazy difficult, and you alluded to this talking to SC, but for new coaching hires to get traction with, you know, existing commits, and at the same time, they're navigating the ability to forge new uncommitted recruit relationships or figure out who he might be bringing on from his old job that he just left. Is there a new coach in this cycle who did an impressive job early on, at least so far after the early period?
Yeah, I would say Florida State for certain. Mike Norvell was able to get a couple of key in-state kids to stick with Florida State, which was always the toughest task when you're replacing a coach, is keeping some of the highly rated commits who might have wandering eye syndrome at that point to stick on board. He was able to flip two quarterbacks. You know, Florida State hadn't signed a high school quarterback since the class of 2017. He comes in and immediately flips Tate Rodemaker from USF out of Valdosta, Georgia. And then more importantly, yesterday, he was able to flip Chuba Purdy, who had been a longtime commit to Louisville, younger brother of Brock Purdy at Iowa State. Because of Norvell's ties into Arizona, when he was at Arizona State as their offensive coordinator, he was able to get Purdy to take an official visit over the weekend and then got him to commit to him yesterday. I think that the big thing for him was, you know, keeping Malachi Wideman on board. He'd been committed since May. He's one of the premier receivers in the country. They haven't, again, he hasn't sent his letter of intent in, but he hasn't gone elsewhere. They've been able to keep the majority of their commits. And speaking of keeping the majority of their commits, the other coach who had as good of a first signing day as you possibly could ask for is Jimmy Lake at Washington. Washington did not lose one commit at all when Chris Peterson announced his retirement or announced that he was leaving. The succession plan that Jen Cohen had in place to replace Chris Peterson with Jimmy Lake allowed for a smooth transition. He didn't lose any commits and actually gained a commit from a DB who had kind of opened things up a little bit in the earlier part of fall. And a lot of it was Jimmy Lake even going to be there? Was he going to leave for another coordinator job or another head coaching job? He ended up committing last week. So Washington ends up with plus one on their commit list. And so he has the highest rated class of any coach that's in his first class. I think Arkansas, Sam Pittman had a couple of key commitments that he was able to get down the stretch. So, you know, a lot to be excited about if you're Arkansas as well. But I think, you know, the hard part is there was a couple schools that lost guys because they lost assistant coaches. And one of those was Ohio State, with Jeff Hafley leaving Ohio State to go to Boston College. You know, their class is still kind of up in the air. He was named so late, but Ohio State lost a commitment this morning from Clark Phillips, who was a top 40 player nationally, a top five cornerback in the country. And Hafley had been his primary recruiter. When Hafley left, he ended up taking an official visit to Utah and then announced this morning he was signing with Utah. So that's the other thing that you see is you see some of these coaches when they leave that positional unit. Now maybe somebody has to pick up the slack late to get recruiting at that position. And I think that that's where, you know, Ohio State's class is so strong. They can handle the loss of Clark Phillips, but it still is one of those 11th hour losses that they're not prepared for. And kind of makes adding another guy late that it makes it more difficult.
One of the things that was pretty evident in watching some of the conference championship games is the talent disparity. Ohio State over Wisconsin. And, you know, for going back a couple weeks, too, I mean, you have Ohio State, Penn State, Ohio State, Michigan. There's just a talent discrepancy in that conference between the top and the near top. Obviously, a huge one in the ACC between Clemson and Virginia. A pretty big one, though, it was a close game between Oklahoma and Baylor. A pretty evident one between Oregon and Utah, if you watch that game. And Oregon-Washington was obviously a closer game, but where in the country at the top of conferences did you see, because of this early signing day, and it's obviously a small sample, but the talent either close or separate even further, with obviously the SEC being pretty narrow between LSU and Georgia?
Yeah, I mean, the easy answer would be to say, well, the SEC, when you've got Alabama 2, Georgia 3, LSU 4, Texas, I mean, six of the top eight schools are from the SEC.
Yep.
But where it starts to become a gap is that, you know, then Florida is a few spots behind. You got South Carolina, but then it starts to become a while before you see more brand names in the SEC. The Big Ten, though, you got Ohio State well in front. You know, Penn State, Michigan, were about 9-10 spots back. But I think the gap's continuing to widen between Ohio State and Michigan and Penn State. You know, the Big 12, it's always going to be Texas and Oklahoma with the best two classes. And they have, again, once again, the best two classes in the conference. I think that the surprising thing, and, you know, and we've talked about this before, the bump you really see when you have a successful next time, it happens in the next cycle. So, you know, Baylor has this great season and they're not really all that high in the rankings. They're outside the top 50.
Right.
And Oklahoma, you know, Texas are continuing to widen the gap from a talent standpoint, but that's where the coaching, I think, makes up for it with a school like Baylor. So, you know, the Big 12 is kind of two that are really standing out and everybody else. The Pac-12, Oregon and Washington are the two teams that for really three straight years now have had the best classes in the Pac-12. But, you know, Stanford has always been a top 25 program in terms of recruiting. Right now, their biggest thing is, where's everybody going? You know, they added a bunch of guys. I think they had their 13th guy go into the portal with KJ Costello. But, you know, the Pac-12, Oregon is starting to distance themselves a little bit more. You know, them and Washington are distancing themselves more with the talent there. And then, of course, you got Clemson. I mean, Florida State's always going to be able to recruit well, even when Willie Taggart seems to be imploding. But this year, the gap between Clemson and Florida State was probably the widest it's ever been. There's 20 teams in between those two schools, and North Carolina and Miami are ahead of Florida State. Now, obviously, part of that was because of the coaching change. But, you know, when Clemson is continuing to lap the rest of the ACC, there's got to be somebody else that has to make it somewhat competitive recruiting-wise.
In recent years, we've seen guys like PJ Fleck, Willie Taggart, Tom Herman find success recruiting to G5 schools and have seen that success carry over to different extents when they've gotten Power 5 jobs. So, is there a current G5 coach that this year or even over the course of these past couple classes where you file it away and say, yeah, this guy resonates with and develops recruits?
Yeah, I think, and we just talked about him a little bit with Mike Norvell. So he's the easiest answer because I thought he was a really good recruiter and he was at Arizona State. He's done a great job of developing and turning Brady White into the quarterback that he's become at Memphis, who came with him when he left Arizona State. And so, you know, now he's in a much easier market to recruit. You know, when you're in Memphis in recruiting, you know, you have to deal with those Memphis kids looking at Ole Miss, going to Mississippi State. Plus, then you have Tennessee on the other side of the state that's trying to recruit. Now he's not having to battle. I mean, yes, he's going to have Miami and Florida that he's going to have to battle and the other schools that will recruit Florida, but he's doing it with a Florida State logo on his shirt rather than a Group of Five school. And so I think much like we've seen PJ Fleck able to take that recruiting effort and energy he had at Western Michigan to Minnesota, I think Norvell's going to be able to do it on an even grander scale because he's at a program like Florida State. I think if, you know, if you look at another guy that, you know, they didn't have the season that I think they had hoped for this year, but Jeff Brohm at Purdue, they have another top 30 class again. And yep. he had a great recruiting class a year ago with a lot of true freshmen that really starred for them this year. George Karlaftis, they had the receiver, Bellis. I mean, and again, another top... Sorry, my phone is tripping up. And they had, you know, they had another top 30 class this year. So he's been able to take that. And again, it's easier to recruit to Big Ten than it was to Conference USA.
Right.
I think so. I think the one coach that, you know, Blake Anderson is a name that I think his energy and his efforts is going to be evident. Here's kind of a wild card one too, that I think, you know, I don't see him leaving just yet, but when he does, it's Nick Rolovich at Hawaii.
Yeah.
I don't think there is a more perfect match for a West Coast program, just in terms of what he will do to market his program, the energy and the love he has for his alma mater. But the reality is Hawaii is never going to be able to have the resources, never going to have the money to afford assistance. I mean, there was a year under Norm Chow where they didn't even recruit during the spring evaluation period on the mainland because they couldn't afford to send coaches over there. Now, Rolovich has done a better job of getting funding because he's an alum. He's got that passion for the university. But if Nick Rolovich ends up at a Power Five conference in the next couple of years, I think you're going to be able to see just what he can do when he's got the resources backing him up, because he's almost a one-man marketing show himself at Hawaii. Again, being that it's his alma mater, there's the emotional ties there. But if he decides that, you know, eventually he wants to go somewhere where he can, you know, be the guy at a major program where he's got the resources in place, I see him being that PJ Fleck type of guy where his energy is just so noticeable that recruits are going to be running through walls to play for him.
Anybody do a good job of evaluating, obviously not at a powerhouse, but, you know, even a couple of years ago, we talked about PJ Fleck and he brought in Rashad Bateman from Georgia, where some guys just have a really great eye for not off the beaten path, but like, oh, that three-star can develop into something. Anybody else that's sort of bowl eligible, 7-5, 8-4 coaches who you really like admire from an evaluation standpoint at a Power Five school right now?
Yeah. And I mean, they weren't 7-5 this year. They were within a game of playing for in the college football playoff, but that's Utah. And again, I mean, you look at that backfield that they have with Zach Moss and Tyler Huntley. These are guys that are overlooked in the state of Florida by the Big Three, and then even by the Big Two after the Big Three. And they go to Utah and they flourish for 3 years in that offense. And, you know, they've done such a great job. And this is what I think the Pac-12 has long feared. What's going to happen when Utah starts pulling in good recruiting classes? Because I don't think anybody can evaluate and develop like Utah has been these last few years. And now they sign with four of the top five players in the state of Utah. They flip an Ohio State commit. They land three Army All-Americans, which is one more than they've ever had combined in the previous 19 years. And now they've been able to, you know, again, they've been able to recruit their state a little bit better. Now those kids that have left the Pac-12 or left Utah to play at other Pac-12 schools, they're now staying. They had an in-state kid that had been a longtime Texas commit. They flipped him. They had one kid that had every Pac-12 school offer plus Notre Dame, Michigan, LSU, Texas. He stays home. You know, they were able to get the top player in New Mexico. They were able to go into Southern California to a couple places that and get guys that were a little bit overlooked. They go down into Texas. They've been going into Texas. They've been going into Florida under Kyle Whittingham and finding some gems that end up coming in and being instant impact guys. And now they have one of their better classes. They're ranked 36th nationally with the recent additions. They had 2 4-stars commit today. And, you know, it's only good for 8th in the Pac-12, but when you're Utah to finish in the top 40, that's remarkable because at one point they were ranked 12th in the Pac-12 this year, and they were playing for the conference championship. So again, now the Pac-12 is getting to see what some success is going to be able to translate to for Kyle Whittingham and his staff.
Are there any assistants? You mentioned Antonio Pierce earlier at ASU. I think he's the linebackers coach, but position coaches, coordinators who stood out this year as being particularly successful and should command hiring attention moving forward, at least partially because of how well they've resonated on the recruiting trail.
Well, I think, you know, the one that I would have used would be Jeff Hathley, you know, the class that he was putting together at Ohio State. Yeah. You know, at one point, you know, he had elite DBs locally and nationally. He had the top safety from the West out of Arizona, the top or the number two corner out of California. You know, and so he wasn't just recruiting locally. He's a New Jersey native. He's from the Northeast, and yet he was resonating nationally. And I think, you know, that's something that Boston College has got to be giddy about, that he's got some national juice. You know, I don't know if Boston College is going to recruit nationally to start, but they're certainly going to try because he's got the connections around the country. But if you're going to talk about what assistant coach is probably positioning himself the best, it's on the other side of the hallway at Ohio State, and it's Brian Hartline. In his first class, his first full recruiting class, he's ranked as the number one recruiter in the 24/7 recruiter rankings. He's got six commits at the receiver, or he's got four receivers coming in. He's got six guys that he's in charge of, but he has three of the top five receivers in the country already committed to Ohio State. They've got the top player in Texas in Jackson Smith Najiba. He's going to end up being probably the state player of the year, shattering Texas receiving records. And I mean, when you think about that for a second, you know, the great state of Texas football, and you're about to get a guy who owns every major receiving record, Julian Fleming, who they got out of Pennsylvania. They were able to stave off Penn State, continuing to try to get him to stay home. G. Scott out of Washington. That was another big one. And, you know, Hartline was a guy that was an interim coach during the last year of Urban Meyer before he was moved into that role. And in his first full recruiting class, he's going to have the best class at any position group in the country, and he's in line to have the top recruiting rankings. But then, you know, you look at some of the guys that that we're used to seeing. You know, Todd Bates, the defensive line coach at Clemson, he's always been able to recruit really well. Carl Scott, who's a DB coach at Alabama, you know, they don't have him just recruiting DBs; they have him recruiting a number of positions. The one guy that, you know, is starting to become a rising star out west, and I know you've probably been a fan of him, is Dante Williams.
Yeah.
You know, he's not just a fantastic DB recruiter, but he was the point man on Justin Flo. And so you have him, you got Keith Hayward, you got Ken Wilson, Joe Salavea, plus Andy Avalos on that defensive staff with a lot of ties all over the West Coast. And Dante Williams is the one who was key in bringing Justin Flo to Oregon. So, you know, he's kind of a new name. You know, he'd been doing a great job of recruiting when he was at San Jose State, did a good job at Arizona and then Nebraska. But when he got to Oregon, it was like, you know, free Dante. And he got to really start to show just what his chops are like this year by getting Justin Flo. And I think that, you know, I don't see that he's going to necessarily be a head coach in a few years, but he's putting himself into coordinator territory, just like I think Hartline, you know, he's going to be with Ryan Day for a long time. But Hartline, with his ability to relay, I mean, you talk to these receiver commits, they glow about him. He played there. He played in the NFL. They feel this connection with him, and he's a very fast rising star in coaching and certainly in recruiting.
The past couple years have been pretty mixed in terms of quarterback classes. I think it was maybe a couple years ago where it was particularly down. And obviously ranking quarterbacks seems to be the biggest wild card because of the sheer number of variables involved in success. So are there guys who is it a good year for quarterbacks this year? Finally, I know there's a couple big ones out west and we had a couple move later on in the process. I know, obviously, you mentioned Chubba Purdy to Florida State. I think Oregon signed a blue chip quarterback from the south in addition to another one from out west. But are there guys who slid under the radar because of injury, school size, growth spurt, transferring, whatever? How is this year in quarterback?
It was solid. I wouldn't say it was great. I mean, you have two kind of generational quarterbacks out of Southern California in Bryce Young, who spurned SC to go to Alabama, with DJ Uiagalelei going to Clemson. But then, you know, CJ Stroud, who's going to Ohio State out of Rancho Cucamonga. You have those three, and then it kind of drops out west. And then nationally, you got a couple of guys in the state of Texas, Hudson Carr out of Lake Travis in Austin, who's going to UT. You got Haynes King, who one of the top dual threat quarterbacks in the country. He's going to A&M. So, you know, Texas had a couple of really good quarterbacks that are both staying local. But then you have the West Coast schools that are the West Coast programs that the three best quarterbacks are all going to three teams that have won a national championship in the last 5 years. In fact, I think Ohio State, Alabama, and Clemson are the only three schools that have won national championships in the playoff era. And three Southern California quarterbacks are going there. So if it weren't for Jay Butterfield, who's, you know, and interestingly enough, one of the major reasons Oregon was able to get Jay Butterfield was because Stanford had a quarterback that they signed in 2018, Tanner McKee, who went on an LDS mission. He's coming back this year. They never offered Jay Butterfield, whose father was a former starting quarterback at Stanford. Any other year, they probably would have offered him, and he goes to Stanford. Instead, he's going to Oregon. And then, like you said, Robbie Ashford was the kid from the South who had been a longtime Ole Miss commit. He's an Under Armour football American and an Under Armour baseball American.
Wow.
One of the best dual sport guys. So that's the one thing Oregon's going to have to worry about is what's going to happen in June if he gets drafted. You know, will he go the baseball route or will he go and play football? But Oregon was able to get two good quarterbacks in this class, and that'll help them when they lose a guy like Justin Herbert. But yeah, I mean, the Elite 11 this year was okay. I mean, I would say one of the best signings that you can really look at yesterday was by a Group of Five school. And that's Evan Prater, who's going to actually be playing in the All-American Bowl in San Antonio. He's from Cincinnati and he's going to Cincinnati.
Wow.
That is one of the better quarterbacks that a Group of Five school has signed really in the last 5 or 6 years. And I think he's going to be a star there for Luke Fickell. And so, you know, it's kind of sobering and indicting when, you know, you have the big three in California, they all leave the state. And then one of the best quarterbacks nationally is a guy going to a Group of Five school. You know, it just quarterback recruiting is impossible almost these days. If you don't start a kid as a true freshman, he'll be in the portal before your opening game. And so coaches always have to recruit with the mentality that I am probably going to lose this guy. It's no longer I may lose this guy.
Right.
You almost have to operate with the understanding like you probably will lose that guy.
Wow. What position was strong? What was deep? What was impressive? Where do you see talent spreading across the country position-wise?
It's easy because this is always probably the most ranked position, which is receiver, but this really is kind of a renaissance year for receivers. I mean, there's just so many special elite pass catchers all throughout the country, in Texas, in Florida, you know, in California, but then in states that you wouldn't necessarily maybe think are producing great receivers, but Washington and Pennsylvania both have elite receivers. And I think, you know, with the rise in 7-on-7 over the last few years, you're seeing in obviously the spread offenses and more offenses using 3 and 4 receivers at a time. You're seeing kind of the receiver position, the importance at it, and just how easy it is to play as a true freshman. We're seeing so many guys play as true freshmen. And it's not just the receiver position per se, but it's also those athletic receiving tight ends. No longer are you finding the big rumbling, stumbling, you know, traditional inline tight ends. You're finding the 6'5", 6'6", 240, 250 pounds that you're flexing out wide and throwing the ball to them. I mean, the National Player of the Year by Gatorade was a tight end, Eric Gilbert out of Marietta, Georgia, who's going to LSU. And there is 7-8 super freaky elite type of tight ends in this class. So it's really a pass catcher game right now. And this is one of the best classes in terms of, you know, true receivers, slot receivers, tight ends, you know, traditional, you know, the wise, the inside receivers. It's becoming more and more like just the requirement to bring in 3 or 4 receivers in each class and play those guys as freshmen. And Ohio State, you know, they are well ahead of everybody else with their receiver class with Julian Fleming, Jackson Smith, Ajiba, and G Scott. You know, they lose some receivers, but then they got a Garrett Wilson to come in. They got a Chris Olave for another year. And now you're bringing in 3 elite receivers. You know, that receiver position, not just at Ohio State, but nationally, is seeing probably its most golden era right now.
Was 2019, and I guess going into 2020, what is creativity? What is relentlessness? You know, what are the teams that are staying ahead of the curve, staying ahead of the pack? What are they doing to sort of separate themselves essentially from schools who are not putting as much focus and resources into recruiting? What does the modern recruiting office look like?
Well, you know, there's a ton of people. You're seeing recruiting staffs that sometimes have 18 to 25 part-time, full-time staffers. You have analysts. You know, it wasn't long ago where we had the era of, you know, a grad assistant who was in charge of recruiting as well as helping with the offensive game plan on a week. Now you have 6 to 8 undergraduate recruiting assistants. And then you have a director of on-campus recruiting. You have a director of high school relations. You have a director of, you know, of recruiting strategy. So you're seeing more and more schools put the resources in having an 18 to 22 person recruiting staff so they can handle the high amount of unofficial visits that school's hosting. They can handle when the coaches are going on the road. They can have a plan in place. And so you're seeing, you know, more and more schools using the spring, the unofficial visits in the spring, or their own spring game as kind of the big one. Oregon has been doing as good a job of any school in the country of having their spring game being kind of the marquee event for recruits. That they have so many recruits that are coming in on their own dime for that unofficial in April to see the spring game, to see Autzen Stadium. You know, when and it's not like it's a Nebraska spring game where there's 75,000 people in the stands, or you know, a Southern, an SEC spring game. But it's getting these kids to come to Oregon on their own dime, unofficially, and seeing the energy of practice. And you know, when you talk to a kid that's on an Oregon unofficial visit, after the trip's over, you ask what was the highlight, and it's before they even get off the elevator in the football facility, they're overwhelmed by 30 to 40 assistant coaches and admins yelling, screaming, cheering for them as they get out of the elevator before they've even started the visit. So you're already starting with one foot ahead, one step ahead of everybody. You see, you know, the pictures that we've seen, the videos that go viral of the photo sessions on the unofficial visits. And you got the Oregon strength and conditioning coaches and the assistant coaches, and they're getting these guys hyped up and letting these guys just be themselves, be their, you know, they're essentially branding themselves. You know, I looked at what like Oklahoma was doing yesterday with each player having their own personalized branding logo. You know, you saw how so many schools are using signing day as a chance to let their marketing team get loose and really show their creativity. And so social media, personal branding, those are the programs, the schools that are ahead of the curve in that stage, in those steps, are the ones that they're signing the big time classes when maybe they don't necessarily have the 11-win season and the glut of first round draft picks to sell. This is how they're selling it. I mean, the puppets that Baylor was doing yesterday, how genius and how brilliant was that? it's quirky. And you can even say it's got a little bit of cheesiness to it, but sure, it worked. Everybody was talking about what Baylor was doing. People were talking about Syracuse's, you know, the superhero graphics. They were talking about what Notre Dame was doing, what Oklahoma was doing, you know. And so the more these kids see the excitement at a program on social media, because these kids are glued. I have two teenagers myself. They're glued to social media. Mm-hmm. And so these recruits who have 30, 40,000 followers that are, you know, speaking the gospel of their school, they're seeing the excitement. Kids are wanting to go on their own to take unofficial visits to the school, and then they're wowed themselves. And that's what the creativity is. It's allowing these kids to be themselves, to have that personal brand. You know, it still helps to win and it still helps put guys in the NFL. But when you don't have that in your, or you don't have a long history of that, you look for the other angles. And those are schools that are being creative, and it's impressing and wowing kids and leading to those kids committing and being a part of that program.
Ty's not on the line, but I'll throw him a bone here. Notre Dame finishes with what looks like a top 10 class in terms of the average commitments or average signee rating. What does Notre Dame's class look like, and who could possibly get on the field pretty early for the Irish?
Probably one of my favorite players in this entire class, you know, regardless of position, is Tosh Baker. He is the number one offensive lineman out on the West Coast. He is he's basically Ronnie Stanley, but what? 8 years later, I wouldn't say he's a former basketball player. The kid's still playing basketball, but that was the big thing for him, is he was doing AAU hoops for the Oakland Soldiers, you know, being the longtime Arizona based Oakland Soldiers. Apparently he's out of Arizona, but he was, you know, and if you follow AAU basketball, you know, the Oakland Soldiers are a prominent program nationally. So he was playing as a 6'8", 275-pound tackle. He's playing as a center. And at the school he was at, Pinnacle High School in Phoenix, they had Nico Mannion, who was a McDonald's All-American now at Arizona. You know, and Tosh Baker is the big guy down low. So you watch this guy with these magical feet, this big guy, and he's got these magical footwork that is coming from his basketball background. And now you put him at left tackle, and you just know that as he continues to add weight and strength, he's got a chance to be a really special left tackle, much like Ronnie Stanley was. And Ronnie Stanley, too, was a high school basketball player who played with an elite guy when he was at Bishop Gorman, but realized once he got to college, hey, I'm going to be a future first rounder, focused on football, and ended up being a top 10 pick. That's a guy that I think Notre Dame fans are going to be really excited about, because he's never spent an entire offseason dedicated exclusively to football, and now he's going to have that. But this is Notre Dame. You know, they like their linemen. They do love those big physical guys, but they also love the guys that get into the end zone. And one guy who's going to be expected to do that a lot is the number one all-purpose back in the country, Chris Tyree out of Virginia. You know, he picked Notre Dame over Oklahoma. It looked like he might end up at Oklahoma, but the number one all-purpose back, I mean, he can be used in so many ways. He can be a return guy. He can be a slot receiver. You can put him in the backfield, use him for end arounds, and he's coming to Notre Dame. They've also got one of the top five receivers in the country. Even though Ohio State kind of has the monopoly there, they've got the number four receiver in Jordan Johnson out of Missouri. They have the guy who I think is probably the best pure all-around tight end in Michael Mayer. I know that, you know, Derek Gilbert's rated ahead of him because of the athleticism, but Mayer's that guy that, you know, he's the Notre Dame tight end that we've been seeing for the last 30 to 40 years. He'll block you one play and then he'll route you on the next way. And then another kid that they got out of Hawaii, one of the last time they got an elite linebacker out of the state of Hawaii, it was Manti Te'o. And here they come back in 2020, getting Jordan Botello out of St. Louis High School, Tua Tagovailoa, Marcus Mariota School. And here's a kid that Notre Dame was able to get largely because Brian Polian was the primary recruiter for Manti Te'o. And he went back to Hawaii and he was the primary recruiter for Botello. And again, going into Hawaii to get, and this guy, he's ruthless and punishing. I mean, he's every bit the physical just maniac that Justin Flo is, and maybe even a little bit more, because he's had some off the field issues with some altercations where some guys decide they want to try to step up to him. So he's actually suspended for his last high school game, which is this weekend against St. Thomas Aquinas. He doesn't get to play in it because of an altercation, but you know, he's that physical guy that's going to come in and be that enforcer in the middle of the defense for Notre Dame.
Fair enough. And obviously we're still in the middle of the 2020 class, but I'm sure you, as is every coach in America, already looking at 2021. So between, I guess, the expected and the unexpected, who is, I guess, exploded off the blocks for 2021 recruits?
Well, you know, you're going to like to hear this because a school that you are fond of yourself. It's Oregon, you know, and part of the reason that they've been able to recruit so well is in that class for 2021 is they've already put the majority of their 2020 class together. So that allowed them to really start to turn their attention to the 2021 class. So out west, I mean, Oregon's got four stars already. They got the number one player in the state of Oregon in Keith Brown, who's at Lebanon. They've got Seven McGee, who's back in Southern California. He's played in New York. They got Kyron Ware-Hudson, whose older brother Keon is a defensive lineman at Oregon right now. So they're a top 10 class in the 21 class. And, you know, Ty's not here, but let's throw him another bone. Right now, Notre Dame's atop the list in the 2021 class with seven commits already, all four stars. They've got a quarterback who is a really fascinating quarterback named Tyler Buckner out of San Diego. He got hurt on the opening series. He didn't start as a freshman. He gets brought up to varsity with about 10 to 12 offers. He was a really high-level lacrosse player as a youth. Gets brought up to varsity as a sophomore. On the opening series of the opening game of the season, he tears his ACL, so he misses his whole sophomore year, but comes back and just shows in the offseason the dynamite in his arm. He commits to Notre Dame in March, comes back and has just a amazing junior season, both running the ball. I mean, you would never be able to tell this guy missed his sophomore year with an ACL injury because of the way he ran and was a San Diego County player of the year. So they've got, you know, he's a top five or top 50 player nationally and elite quarterback. So they've gotten a lot of help already on the offensive side of the ball. A couple of receivers committed, a tight end committed, a quarterback, and a couple of offensive linemen. So, you know, this is the Solid Verbal top 10 rankings, but it's, you know, that's how it's looking. And then, of course, the usual suspects already starting strong for 2021, Ohio State 2, Texas 3, Florida, Miami 4 and 5. And then kind of a surprise there, Wisconsin sitting then early at the number 6 position. And I think that, you know, again, like we talked about with North Carolina, these are schools. Wisconsin is one of those schools that they usually have the upper hand because of their ability to evaluate and develop. But if they start getting some good recruits coming in, you know, that could be a problem for that division in the Big Ten.
Wow. All right. Brandon Huffman, thank you very much for your time. That was exhaustive, but not exhausting. There is a difference. Be sure to follow Brandon. Be sure to find all of his work on 24/7 Sports. This is a year-round thing, as everybody listening knows, and nobody does it better than Brandon. Brandon, thank you very much for your time.
Dan, I appreciate it. Always great talking to you. And please tell Ty I said hello.
All righty, Dan, there you go. There he is, the Huff. He's back.
Oh, man. The best. The best. Undefeated. Yeah, alarming detail, like you predicted. And interesting hearing his thoughts about new coaches. I'm always interested to hear what modern recruiting departments look like. And I'm glad he touched on that, because it's one of the reasons people have pointed to where Urban Meyer wasn't fully sold on USC, that the infrastructure of their program, including the recruiting department, with Ohio State and Florida before that, taking so many steps to be so completely all in for recruiting and the student athlete experience. It's fascinating to hear how many people are employed to either completely or mostly operate in the recruiting world.
Nuts.
Social media and everything like that. So, fascinating stuff, and glad he got to point out some smaller schools and some Power Five programs that don't necessarily get the attention that they deserve and what they've done on the recruiting trail. So, always great.
All right. Well, that was a lot of fun. Thank you again to our friend Brandon Huffman from 24/7 for stopping on by, giving us some of his perspectives. Yeah, that's your playoff preview. That's your signing day recap. We will be back in a few short days to talk about other bowl action. But Dan, in the meantime, I think that's all I got.
That's all I got as well.
For that guy over there, my good friend Dan Rubenstein, for myself, Ty Hildenbrand, we will catch you all. Talk more bowls in a few short days. In the meantime, stay solid.
Peace.
If you travel, you know when it comes to love.
See you soon.
Can't wait.
The sky is no limit. You know, with your Delta Amex card, being oceans apart means meeting in Aruba. And booking a war travel with your card means saving 15% on Delta flights. You know, kissing under the bridge of sighs guarantees eternal love. Because you're the long-distance lovebirds. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Take off 15 discount not applicable to partner operated flights or taxes and fees. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/you know.